Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
The University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and the Royal College of Surgeons Ireland have partnered together to establish a concussion fellowship in honour of the late US Ambassador to Ireland, Dan Rooney. Rooney, who passed away in 2017, was famous in his native United States as the owner of the American football team, the Pittsburgh Steelers, and in Ireland as a great philanthropist, a supporter of Irish cultural, educational, and charitable causes, and late in life as US Ambassador from 2009 to 2012 under President Obama. The fellow will be responsible for the development and implementation of a sport-related concussion research program in Ireland in partnership with RCSI. Now, interested candidates are invited to visit www.upmc.ie for more information or to apply online. And the closing date for applications is Monday, May the 24th at 5 o'clock. To talk about the hot topic of concussion in sport, we're delighted to be joined by Michael Mickey Collins, PhD, Clinical and Executive Director of the UPMC Sports Medicine Concussion Program and an internationally renowned expert in sports-related concussion. Mickey, thanks for speaking to Off the Ball. Good afternoon.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Mickey, concussion at the moment in sport, in our discourse, is a very red-hot topic at the moment for, I think, a number of reasons. People are learning a bit lot more about this issue. We've seen the NFL settlement in the United States for $765 million. In rugby, there was a case with Steve Thompson, the England World Cup winner of 2003, being diagnosed with early onset dementia. He's in his early 40s last December. Jeff Astle, a footballer who played for England, his death was described as death by industrial disease. So it's a serious issue. It'll be fascinating to hear your expertise and insight over the next while. What is your own background, Mickey?
I'm a clinical neuropsychologist. I specialize in brain behavior relationships. I'm also a former athlete, washed up, I might add, but I was a former athlete. Baseball here in America, I was a baseball player. I've always had love for sports and the brain, and somehow I've combined that to have a profession. And I direct the UPMC concussion program here in Pittsburgh, and we see about 20,000 cases a year come through our clinic. And so I'm a clinician. I see patients from sunup to sundown, pretty much, you know, 5 to 6 days a week. And we're doing a lot of research on concussion, a lot of treatment, and really tremendous advances in our understanding of this injury. So I'm excited to talk to you, John, and share some of those insights.
Not everybody watching or listening, Mickey, will be an elite athlete or a sports person, a professional sports person. Maybe to the people that are not as au fait with others, what is concussion?
The word concussus literally translates from Latin to English to mean to shake violently. And you think about your brain as an egg yolk inside an eggshell. What causes concussion is the egg yolk moving inside the shell. And not to get too much in the weeds on this, but what causes concussion is the membrane to the neuron will stretch when the brain moves in the skull. And this little chemical called potassium will leak out of the cell, which increases the demand for energy or glucose. At the same time, calcium, which is supposed to be outside the cell, will leak into the cell, and it causes a constriction of our blood vessels. And all you need to know about concussion is that it's an energy crisis to the cell and neuron in the brain. There's an increased demand for energy, and it's not met through blood flow. And so it's an energy crisis. Now, fortunately, cells don't die with that energy problem. It's just certain systems in the brain can decompensate from that energy problem. And we've actually learned that there's different types of concussions based upon that energy problem that happens.
Is it a treatable issue, concussion?
It is, yes. I firmly believe that. There's very few patients that leave our clinic that aren't symptom-free and doing extremely well when they're done with us. And the advances in our treatments are robust. We've now learned there's six different types of concussions. And for each of those different types, we have different treatments and different approaches and different physical therapies. And yes, we can treat the problems that we see from concussion in an active and targeted way and get patients to feel normal when they're done. And that's one of the biggest misperceptions out there, is that there aren't treatments for this. There are. And it really concerns me when I hear stories of athletes that are having problems and haven't been evaluated in a comprehensive way, because some of those problems I would almost guarantee are treatable. And we see patients here. I saw patients today. I just got done my clinic day here. I think I saw 25 or 30 patients, and you know, some of them were 2-3 years out from injury, and we'll get them better. And I can say that confidently. We have a lot of research showing that our treatments work, and we're really making a lot of advances with this.
Has there been a buy-in from sporting bodies, from organizations, from different sports into what you're doing?
Yes. I can tell you one of the places that's bought in is the GAA. They've been phenomenal in supporting and collaborating with us and us sharing our knowledge with them and getting to a point where we're educating clinicians in Ireland our treatment model. In fact, we have 7 locations across Ireland now that are open and ready to see patients to treat concussion the way we treat it here in Pittsburgh. We've spent months and months of time training those clinicians and getting them up to speed on our treatment model. And there's incredible advances in treatment that are occurring in your country right now as a result. And we have clinics in Waterford and Dublin and Cork and many other places across the country where we've trained clinicians. They've come here to Pittsburgh, learned our model. We have case conferences every Friday morning. We go over cases. And the GAA supported all that. And so in time, as this model expands, I'm really optimistic that those that may not have received treatment will be aware that it exists and receive the proper treatment for the problems they're having.
In rugby, they have a head injury assessment at the moment. In professional football in the UK, there's a bit of a row at the moment because there are permanent concussion substitutions. Well, PFA and FIFPro want temporary substitutions because they don't want medical staff under pressure. Is there a correct way on a sporting field for concussion to be treated?
We've made a lot of advances with that in terms of, I would actually use the word assessment on the field. The treatment parts with removing the players from the field that are concussed, because if you continue to play through that injury, we see very adverse outcomes. In fact, we just published a study which shows if you're an athlete that has a concussion on the field, we compared a group of athletes that were taken out of play immediately at the time they had a concussion, and we looked at a group of athletes that played only 15 minutes beyond the point of having symptoms and then were removed. The athletes that were removed immediately recovered in half the time as those that recovered that played for 15 minutes or longer with symptoms. And so the best way to prevent problems with concussion is to manage it effectively when you have one, and getting players off the pitch is absolutely essential to mitigating poor outcomes. Now, in terms of the assessment part of this in the field, we've made a lot of advances there. And in fact, those advances, we're going to be training clinicians as to how to do the types of tests that need to be done on the sideline to do the proper evaluation. And it's exciting, some of the advances we've made. Look, there's no blood marker for this test. There's no biomarker. There's no image. There's no saliva test right now that can effectively diagnose concussion and then delineate who has good outcomes, who have bad outcomes. There's no biomarker at this moment. And there probably won't be, honestly, for a while until it's ready for prime time. There's a lot of smart people working on that. Right now, we have to do a clinical evaluation. We know what the right clinical evaluation is for this injury, and we can do it in a fairly streamlined manner and do the right on-field care. But there's teaching that needs to go into that. There's knowledge that needs to go into that, and that will take time before we reach that point. But I can tell you, clinicians like Sean Moffitt and Enda Devitt and Neve Lynch and others in Ireland are very familiar with how we evaluate this injury, and we'll be doing trainings on those things in time here in terms of how to properly evaluate this.
What are the worst issues or cases of concussion that you've seen, and what were the reasons or the markers for these issues to become very, very serious for you?
The number one marker is an athlete who's concussed that continues to play through that concussion, and we don't want to see that happen. We've done a lot of research on risk factors for poor outcome from concussion, and I bet it will surprise you some of those risk factors. A history of car sickness is a risk factor for a poor outcome from concussion. Not a devastating chronic, you know, life-changing outcome, but people who have a history of car sickness are more likely to have a concussion and have a specific type of concussion that doesn't feel real good to go through. People with a history of amblyopia or strabismus or lazy eye are at risk for concussion. People with a history of migraine, people with a history of anxiety are at risk for concussion. And females are more likely to have concussion than male for a variety of reasons that we've published on and studied. There are definitely risk factors. When I talk about the fact there's different types of concussions, there's really six different types. And the risk factors that you have lead you into one of those types of concussion. For example, if you have a history of migraine, you're more likely to have migraine after a concussion. If you have a history of anxiety, you're more likely to be anxious. If you have a history of lazy eye, you're more likely to have ocular issues. If you have a history of car sickness, you're more likely to have vestibular problems. And we see that different biomechanical force will cause concussion in those patients and those patients that don't have that history. So less force causes the injury in those patients. The good news is now that we understand all that, we have targeted treatments to treat those patients and rehab those patients and get them better fully before we put them back to play.
Talked about the GA there, Mickey, and rugby is facing a lot of news print and all that kind of thing about and discussion around concussion and early onset dementia with the Steve Thompson issue in the UK, which was revealed last December. Rugby, when I grew up watching it, was a game of evasion. The Guardian had a report that in 1987, the first World Cup, there were 94 tackles average per game. It was 257 at the 2019 World Cup. Am I wrong to suggest as a sport that rugby is facing a ticking time bomb or a massive bill in 20 to 30 years time of players having issues with brain injury because of all these collisions, and they don't know at the moment what damage could be happening to them?
It's a complicated question. And my response to that is that the advances we've made in our treatment of this injury, if those things are implemented, I don't look at this as a ticking time bomb because I look at concussion as a treatable problem. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about this injury. And I do think that we can mitigate poor outcomes by proper treatment and management. It's just that knowledge has really been delivered in the last, you know, decade. And it takes time for that knowledge to translate to clinical care. Do I think that there's some players that can have chronic problems from this injury and really have poor outcomes? Definitely. There's no question of that. But if we can intervene early on, we can see those problems mitigated and thwarted. You know, you don't need to have chronic problems with this injury if it's effectively treated. Look, I know the IRFU very well. I know their leadership. I know they have very good leadership on this issue. And I know that they're working hard to get the right knowledge out there and to get the right protocols out there to treat this effectively. And there's very smart, proactive, informed people involved with that. And I think you'll see the right changes in time here.
Are players more at risk of brain issues in their future life with repeated concussions as opposed to players that get less of them?
Yes. The best form of prevention is to manage concussion effectively when you have one. And if you have an athlete that's not fully recovered from concussion and they continue to play, that's when you go down a pathway that can be poor and can lead to problems. And we can't treat what we don't see, you know, we can't treat what we don't hear. And athletes need to understand that they need being aware of the signs and symptoms of this injury and then going to the right clinic to be treated is essential. And the right specialist to be treated is essential. There's a responsibility on the athlete's part to understand that they need to remove themselves from play if they're having symptoms. Now, look, as a former athlete, I would run through a wall to play my sport. I get it. But there's an awareness here that's increasing, and I think athletes are taking more of a responsibility with that. And I also think that responsibility would be sharpened if they were aware that there's actually effective treatments. And it's not rest. We don't rest concussion to treat it. We targetedly activate and rehab the injury. And a lot of folks listening to this might think that, oh, you have a concussion, you sit in a dark room. I don't do that with my patients at all. I don't tell them to get off their phones. I don't tell them to go into dark rooms. I exercise them in specific ways. I do active rehab strategies. We don't take kids out of school very often at all. We actually allow athletes to go back to certain activities and things. We don't put them in sunglasses. It's active treatment that we have. And there's just so much poor information out there about how we treat concussion that patients that report those problems, they're almost punished for it. And I think if athletes are aware that there's really targeted and active treatments, I think they'd be a lot more likely to report their symptoms as well.
What types of treatments are we talking about?
Active rehabilitation, things like vestibular therapy, ocular therapy, exertion therapy, behavioral management of it. There's different systems in the brain that can decompensate from this injury. And we have physical therapies to retrain those systems, whether it's the eyes or the vestibular system or other aspects of the injury. The GAA and UPMC have combined to spend years putting forth the UPMC Concussion Network, where you have ability by clinicians in your country right now to receive those treatments. I think we have 7 clinics in Ireland right now that are seeing patients. I think we've seen well over 500 to 1,000 cases already in Ireland that are receiving these treatments. And that program will grow and grow and grow as the awareness increases. And so every Friday morning at 7:15 my time, I have a case conference with those clinicians that are trained by us. And we go through cases in Ireland, and we're and it's really, really cool what is transpiring there in your country in terms of care for this injury. And you got some really sharp clinicians over there doing great work.
Contact training, is that something that maybe should be reduced or restricted in sports like rugby? In American football, they did alter it after their issues with the concussion and brain issues. You don't think so?
I do think that, I think the NFL has done a really good job here in this country of putting data behind game changes and rule changes that have led to reduced frequency of concussion. And the numbers support that. There's been changes on kickoffs here in this country that's resulted in fewer concussions. There's really strict protocols in place that have resulted in better care and awareness for the injury, more sets of eyes on the issues. Rugby's doing that in Ireland in many, many shapes and forms. The GAA is working on that. I mean, obviously, the best form of prevention is, not having a concussion. If we can reduce the incidence of that through rule changes and through styles of play changes. But I don't think that should be done willy-nilly, and just what may seem intuitive or logical may not actually have any result, and it may change the game to be more dangerous. So it needs to be done through data and research and epidemiology and all kinds of different things. And people are doing good work in that area, and that's being done across different sports in your country as well.
I was reading a Willie Stewart, who's a neuropathologist in the University of Glasgow, did a study that found the former players, and this was between, I think, the 1920s and 1970s, were 3.5 times more likely to die of neurodegenerative diseases. We've had World Cup winners from the 1966 England soccer team have died of dementia. We've had Martin Peters, Jack Charlton, our former Ireland manager, Ray Wilson and Nobby Stiles. Do you think there's a accelerated risk of heading the football connected to brain injury?
We don't know the answer to that. There's more research that needs to be done looking at that in the long term. There's a lot of variables that can account for the problems that we're seeing, and we don't have great control of some of those variables. Now, we have a study ongoing here in the United States right now where we're looking at the potential effects of long-term effects of concussions and living former NFL players. It's the largest study that has been done to date looking at this issue. We have an extremely good control group versus a group that played football at least 3 years in the NFL. And we're doing an extremely comprehensive evaluation of those players and comparing it to control data. That research will answer a lot of questions in time. And science takes time and takes replication and takes really good methodology. And that's frustrating to hear as a person that just wants to know answers. But without answering those through science, it's difficult to provide the right answer. So in time, there will be a lot more clarity in these issues. And I think heading the soccer ball falls into that. I can tell you that I see players that here that head the ball and have concussions. But a lot of times those players have had a head injury that wasn't treated properly. They may have a history of an ocular problem or have a history of car sickness that puts them at more risk for less force causing injury. They may not be aware they had a problem with concussion, then they had the ball and have symptoms. So it's complicated. And I can tell you in my experience, in patients that don't have a lot of risk factors and they use proper heading technique and proper form, they're completely fine. And I have no problem with heading the soccer ball at all. And I think it's actually an important part of the game. So I'm not a big believer in, I put it this way, in the data that's been presented to me and I've read, I don't think we should need to ban heading in soccer at this point in time. I think we need a better awareness of how to mitigate those problems and how to treat it effectively.
This is assessment, this is treatment, this is getting it at the right time is what I'm hearing from you, Mickey, and managing risk effectively. The speed of the soccer ball hitting the head, is that something that in any way is an issue? With obviously the balls are lighter these days.
Well, you know, force equals mass times acceleration, you know, so the faster something goes, the more force there is. So yes, it will play a role in the brain moving inside the skull, which is ultimately what causes concussion. But again, someone with proper heading form, with proper neck strength, with proper neurological health, I don't think there's anyone that will run into problems with this injury if it's, you know, I think heading the soccer ball is a viable thing that can lead, you know, that's not going to lead to problems in patients that perhaps do it the right way. But again, we need more research in looking at all those issues. But I think until we have that data, my anecdotal feeling on this is that a lot of players are completely fine heading the soccer ball. And I just think it's a better awareness around some of the issues it warranted.
Are there legal and financial implications around this issue, Mickey, head injuries going forward? Do you see a point whereby organizations, clubs, teams will have to get a player to sign a form, a risk waiver, acknowledging the risk, dissolving any issues around liability for organizations in the future, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. And I'm not going to get into, I don't really know that. That's not my area of expertise. What I can tell you though, is that we don't have all the answers on these issues at this point in time. The research is coming forward very rapidly in terms of answering some of these questions. And I think some of those issues will be better delineated once we have that data to understand the issues more clearly.
When you're speaking to parents of kids that might be just a little bit concerned about their children playing contact sport with all these stories and all this news about early onset dementia and rugby and heading of the soccer ball, what would you say to them?
I'd say to them that concussion's a treatable problem. We have made tremendous advances. I'd educate them on the signs and symptoms of the injury and to be aware of those signs and symptoms and to make sure that they're removed from play if they're having those problems. And then get to the right clinic, and I stress get to the right clinic in terms of receiving the proper treatment. And if you do that, I think sports are one of the best things in the world for kids to be involved with.
Are there differences in the effects of concussion on a younger person versus an adult? Is there a tipping point, as it were, when the brain is fully developed?
We've published research on that, and we've actually found high school athletes take longer to recover than college athletes and professional athletes, and some of that may have to do with brain maturation, some of that may have to do with neck strength, some of that may have to do with the fact that migraines are more likely to occur in a 13 or 14 year old than in an adult, the onset of migraine. And so migraine's a big risk factor, so that may play a role. There's a lot of hormonal changes happening at that age, so that can play a role. But yeah, we do find that the injury takes a little longer to resolve in the high school athlete than it does in the professional athlete or college athlete.
You've enjoyed working with the GA. It's an amateur sport here, but we've had issues of players being concussed and playing on during games. Hurling is quite a physical sport. They wear helmets, but you seem to be very encouraged by what you've seen and the work they've been doing.
I am, and genuinely. The GA had me over there in, I think it was 2000, 16, 17, where we, and myself and our team here, went over and did lectures, and that propagated a relationship between UPMC, my hospital, and the GAA. And since that time, UPMC has become more widely used over in Ireland, and the concussion program has grown. And the end result of that is really good clinical care happening in Ireland for this injury. And the GAA, if they hadn't invited us over there, this wouldn't have happened. And they've been very open and understanding the advances that are made in terms of treatment assessment. They've got great leadership, whom I've met and trust and think they do a great job. And they really have the best interests of the kids at heart that are playing their sports. And it's hard to implement protocols across, and it's a large organization. And I think they're doing a very good job in implementing things the right way. And it takes time. It takes leadership. It takes the right knowledge. And I think that's happening.
Don Rooney, are you a Steelers man yourself, Mickey?
You can see my helmet in the background there. Yes, I am. Of course I am. Yes. I work out. My two buildings down from here is the Steelers headquarters. So I work right at the Steelers facility, actually.
The connection between Ireland, obviously, with Dan Rooney was quite deep, with Barack Obama appointing him as ambassador between 2009 and 2012.
Yeah, I'm a big Dan Rooney fan. I'm a big Mr. Art Rooney fan. The family has done so much in terms of sports, culture, you know, community things here in Pittsburgh. And Mr. Dan Rooney, who is the ambassador to Ireland, he passed a few years back, but I every year he would give me Irish literature to read and then quiz me on it. I'm a big Irish literature fan. He loved your country and loved the people. And the fact that our fellowship is named under his name is such an honor and privilege. And whoever fills that fellowship is going to have a big shoes to fill. I can tell you that. And they're going to hopefully provide incredible leadership as it comes to, you know, researching this injury in Ireland. And I know Mr. Rooney and his son are huge supporters of advancing concussion care. And it's a big passion they had amongst many, many other things that they've done successfully. So it's really cool that the fellowship is named under Dan Rooney. He's a wonderful man. And yes, I'm a huge Steelers guy, and we're in Steelers country here.
Absolutely. And many Super Bowls you've won as well. What's your main message really then, Mickey, to conclude? What would you like to see when it comes to concussion and sport and the links and the discourse around that over the next 5 years, for example?
The discourse I'd like to hear is that there's advances in treatment. In fact, this is a treatable injury, that kids and parents are aware of the signs and symptoms of the injury, that players are taken out of play when they have those signs and symptoms, that they go to a clinic and receive the proper care. And I want to stress that, going to the right clinics to receive the right diagnosis and the right treatment. And once we do that, you know, awareness with no solution is called hysteria. Awareness with a very good solution, where you have a treatable injury and it's managed effectively, is going to result in a lot better understanding of this injury. And I think that that ticking time bomb you talked about earlier, that's not the case. We can manage this injury effectively in the great, great, great majority of the time. And having kids feel confident when they play sports, and having parents be confident that their kids are playing sports, I think that's a very achievable goal. I do feel that we have a lot to learn here, but I want your culture to trust the research and trust the science and trust the advances. And I think the conversations will change once that occurs. There's nothing better than sport for kids' developments and for the world in general, right? So And I think it's very achievable that this can be an injury that's well understood and well managed. And I think that's what we're aiming for here.
Well, Mickey, thank you for lending your expertise, your insight over the last while on Off the Ball here on Saturday into the serious issue of concussion. Go Steelers, mind yourself and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, John. It was really nice meeting you. And thanks for having me on.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.